You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 7th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, what's guys, up, kids? Good news, everyone.
Yes. Yes.
I love saying that. Our book is available for pre-sale on Amazon.com.
We wrote a book.
Awesome.
Wait, when did this happen?
The book.
It's more than a book.
As we've been hinting at over the last year, basically, we wrote a book. The book is called The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Yes.
But it does have a subtitle. The subtitle is How to Know What's Really Real in a World Increasingly Full of Fake.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Do you know who came up with that?
Stephen Novella?
No. I mean, we were working different permutations of that, but actually that sort of
it was
final
George, right?
Formula, it was actually Kira. George.
No way.
Kira. Yeah.
Oh. Way to go, Kira.
All right, Kira. Thank you.
So, yeah. So we're really excited. You could actually go on Amazon.com. Our cover hasn't been finalized yet, but we're working diligently with their art team just to tweak that cover, get it to the final version. I didn't realize it was going to come out so much ahead of the book. The book is going to be released October 2nd.
Just in time for my birthday.
I found out the book was available by reading it on Reddit.
Okay.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thanks for keeping you in the loop there.
What the hell, man?
Yeah.
Once the book gets in like the queue at a publisher, like they're doing all sorts of stuff from a marketing perspective that we don't even know about.
Yeah, I know. The machine is grinding away. We're basically done, you know, with our part of it. It's written, it's edited. We still have to be involved. I mean, we still have to, you know, we'll still be working over the next 6 months or so on all the production details. But yeah, they're chugging away at their end. So yeah, this is really exciting. So a lot of people have asked us, what is the book about? What's it like? And it's actually a response to feedback that we've been getting from our listeners over the last 13 years. A couple of things, right? So a lot of people ask us, this is a very frequent question that we get. If I'm going to introduce somebody to scientific skepticism, to the skeptical movement, to skepticism itself, what would be like the one good book to get them started?
Yeah.
And while there are some good books out there, there's no perfect book. And my go-to has been Demon Haunted World. But as we discussed recently on the show, it's still a great book, but it's a little dated. It's getting progressively dated, and it's not necessarily the best reflection of the current movement and the current state of the art, if you will, of skepticism.
It's also like, I mean, it's obviously it's Sagan and it's incredible, but it's not his easiest read. I think it's his most accessible read, but I still think for some people it can be a lot if that's their first book. Don't you?
That's not my issue with it as the first book. It's like it's not really a primer on skepticism.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's more of his approach to life. But a lot of great skeptical content in it. But so we designed our book to be exactly like the best introduction to skepticism for somebody who has no idea what it is. But also, another question that we frequently get is there a reference for somebody who is a skeptic, who's been listening to the show for years, is there some place they can go? A guide, if you will.
You know, somewhere a guide.
Where that would have a thorough treatment of all of the critical thinking stuff that we talk about. Like, all right, they just want a thorough reference walkthrough. Here's everything a skeptic needs to know. And so the book is designed to be that too. And I think we accomplished that. So we had basically three goals in terms of the content. You know, stylistically, we wanted it to be accessible and a breezy read and dense with good information. I think we accomplished that. And then in terms of the content, we wanted it to be a great introduction to skepticism, a great reference to people who are already skeptical, and to include some new information so that, remember, we talked about this a lot when we were writing our chapters. You have to make sure that you throw something in there that even if people have been listening to every episode for the last 13 years, you will learn something new when you read this book.
Yes.
And also, we wanted it to be like the answer in a sense, meaning that it has pretty much everything covered in it. It's skepticism and critical thinking 101. So if you read it and you digest it and you really absorb the material that's in there, you will have a fantastic background or a backbone of critical thinking. We also included some personal stories and anecdotes from our lives and experiences that we've had over the past, you know, we've been doing this over 25 years now. And also we wrote this book because it was the first book. It was our entry book into us writing a series of books. We already, you know, have come up with what the next three books are going to be. So buy the book three times.
I understand it makes a wonderful gift.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
and or paperweight.
Now, well, seriously, though, this has been a great learning experience about how the publishing industry works because, you know, margins are increasingly tight in book publishing. So apparently books either make it or they don't. You know what I mean? And if you're going to make it, you're going to make it in the first week or two. So it's really, you have one shot. What publishing companies do is they produce a lot of books so that one or two may hit and they just ignore the rest, just hoping to break even on all the rest. So we need to be that one or two book that peaks up above the crowd in the first couple of weeks. And because of the way the system works, the pre-orders count towards the first week of sales. So we do want people to pre-order the book.
Definitely.
And that will really, really help promote the book. It'll help launch our book writing career, you know, as the SGU. It'll help spread skepticism. Mm-hmm. We obviously have months to go. There's no rush. But yeah, if you are thinking, oh yeah, this would be something that I'd like to get, I'd like to give to somebody, I'd like to have my own reference, you know, we do want to have all of those sales sort of over a short period of time so that we can get, you know, get on bestseller lists and then the book becomes a thing.
And otherwise it'll be harder for us to write any more books in the future.
Oh, there's that too.
That's right.
Yeah, so we'll be talking more about it. We'll be revealing the new book cover when it comes out and keeping you guys updated. And again, we really appreciate your support with this project.
Actually, this is a good time to mention that next Thursday, right? So that's March 15th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, American Eastern Time. We are going to be doing our next live streaming event. We'll be live streaming to the SGU Facebook page. I think we go like for 3 hours. It'll be from 7 to 10. We may go, you know, there's no hard stop. We may go beyond that. And it's going to be a typical live event. We're going to have lots of content. It's kind of short notice. I don't know if we're going to be able to get some guests in the studio, but we always try to do that as well. But at the very least, it'll be the five of us. And we will give more details about what's in the book. We're going to be talking about the book a lot during that live event, in addition to all the usual types of content that we bring. We'll also be talking about our new Patreon page, which we mentioned last week on the show, but we'll give you an update on that later in the show as well. All right, Kara, get us started with what's the word?
Ooh, what's the word this week is complicated. Okay, this is a good one. It was recommended by Daniel Charlesworth from Melbourne, Australia. You like that? Melbourne?
Yeah.
Good job.
Not Melbourne.
Thank you. No, it's Melbourne. He said he was listening to Sam Harris's podcast, and his guest noted that people often didn't understand the difference between the term heritable and inheritable.
Ooh.
And after thinking about it, he realized he was one of those people, and he looked it up and still doesn't really understand the difference. Well, you know what, Daniel? I don't either, but we'll see if we can't figure this out together. Okay, I think that the confusion here is that, as Steve points out quite often, language iterates.
Yes.
Language changes with the times. And also, language is contextual. So heritable versus inheritable depends on the usage of the term. The truth is, if you look up Merriam-Webster, the first definition of both words is basically the same. So that's the first one in time. Heritable says capable of being inherited or of passing by inheritance. Inheritable says capable of being inherited or transmissible. But if you look at the second definition, this is where things start to get a little more clear, but not really. The second definition says under heritable, hereditary, and under inheritable, capable of taking by inheritance, aka the eldest son is inheritable to the crown. So when you actually look at these two words from a copy editing perspective, the way that journalists look at these words when they're using them in print, they'll say that in certain contexts, yes, they are completely synonymous, but in other contexts, they mean two very different things. That heritable, like the word hereditary, is used when we're talking about genetics, when we're talking about traits that are passed along. inheritable is often used, again, by editors and journalists when talking about things that are passed on outside of the body, like property or titles or wealth. So you would inherit, you know, some sort of home or a car, but your eye color is heritable. Now, it gets even more complicated when we look at them within the scientific world, because within the scientific world, we use the terms heritable and inheritable. Oftentimes, we talk about them as if they're the same thing, but there is a very specific definition within evolution and within genetics. Heritability is how much of a specific trait is due to genetic variation as opposed to environmental variation or some sort of error. So something can be heritable due to nature or nurture, because it's the probability of a trait showing up in a, let's say, a son or a daughter that's carried by a mother or a father. Inherited traits are directly passed down from parents to children. They are genetic by their very nature. And that is sort of an important difference when we talk about this within the genetic, the specifically biological world. So we share half our genes from our mom, half our genes from our dad, which means a quarter from each maternal grandparent and a quarter from each paternal grandparent. And we inherit those genes from them. We know what we inherit. It's a mathematical situation. But heritability, how likely we are to have a certain trait that our parent had, has to do with both our genes and the environment. Were those genes switched on or off? Were we raised a certain way that we developed some sort of trait? So often there we're talking about phenotype. And that's kind of the really important distinction, but it's a subtle one and it's a little bit complicated.
Kara, there's also the concept of penetrance.
Ooh, that's sure what? Come on, Steve.
Seriously, when else are we going to talk about penetrance?
It's a family show over here.
For shame. Okay, what's penetrance?
Penetrance is the percentage of a genotype that expresses the phenotype. So genetic diseases have a certain penetrance. A lot of them are 100%, right? Like you have the gene, you have the disease, period. Yeah. But some of them are not. Only maybe like 40% of the people with the gene will get the disease. So the penetrance is only 40% in that case. Yeah.
It's a ratio of genotype to phenotype.
Yeah, exactly. What percentage of the people with that genotype will get the phenotype? And it's usually a disease that we're talking about.
So something like Huntington's, which is probably like 100% if you're carrying both recessive alleles and you're in that 25%. Or I'm sorry, no, it's dominant. So you've got 3/4 only if both your parents are recessive, would you not have
it? All right,
it?
So Huntington's is an even more complicated.
Oh, because it's not simple dominance? Crap. Okay, then we won't
get
into
that. Well, no, I'll tell you what. It's very interesting. Huntington's is a trinucleotide repeat. Mm. So there's the gene defect is a repeating sequence of 3 nucleotides. And there, the greater the number of copies of those 3 nucleotides, the greater the penetrance, the more severe the disease.
And the earlier you get it.
And the earlier you get it, yes. Yeah. So that disease also displays what's called anticipation because usually the first person to come to medical attention is not the first person with the defect. Usually their parents had it, but because there's also amplification. So amplification means it gets worse with each generation. Anticipation means somebody will have had the genetics prior to the first person to express the phenotype.
But that's really interesting, Steve. So something maybe even like propensity towards cancer, like if you have a BRCA gene or something like that, that's going to have a really low penetrance versus...
Well, so the penetrance only applies to diseases which are inherited, but we don't use that term when you're talking about diseases that are predisposed. So,
gotcha. If you have a gene, that's not even low penetrance. That's something completely different.
It's a predisposition. It's not inheritable, right? So inheritable means the gene equals the disease. predisposition means you're just more likely to get the disease if you have mm-hmm. this gene versus that allele. Like we have identified alleles that predispose to Alzheimer's, but Alzheimer's is not an inheritable disease. It's a disease that has genetic predisposition.
Huh.
So we have to make that distinction as well. I know, again, and there's even other layers there, but that, so it does get complicated when we're talking about genetic inheritance. But yeah, it is fun to know that there's all these other layers there, you know, but you just happened to bring up an example that was particularly complicated because it was one of the trinucleotide repeats.
Well, yeah. And of course, there's this great Scientific American coverage of this from several years ago by Danielle Lee. I don't know if you guys ever read DN Lee, but she's awesome. She has a column called The Urban Scientist, and she does a lot of like cool hip hop courses when she teaches science. And so this one is called Hip Hop Evolution Files, Heritable Traits versus Inherited Traits. And she teaches a senior level evolution class. It's one of her earliest classes that she teaches with hip hop, and she quizzes them using a juvenile song called Mama Got Ass. She get it from her mama. It's so funny. So there's these questions where she goes, oh, where she get her eyes from? She get it from her mama. And then they're like, that's inherited. Oh, where she get her thighs from? She get it from her mama. Okay, that's inherited. Where she learned to cook from? That's heritable. It's like such a great example. So I highly recommend that you read this blog post. It's super funny.
I'm not a big fan of penetrants.
I don't like it either.
I think it should be the opposite, like something that's not penetrating but emerging, like, I don't know, egressence.
Yeah, but emergence has a whole other meaning that's already complicated and taken.
No, it's like how much does it penetrate into the next generation?
I get it. I just don't like it.
Oh, gosh.
I don't like it because it sounds dirty.
Geneticists have their own jargon.
But that's the best part about it.
Sometimes they use words differently just in their own field. You know, like technical jargon in medicine has its own definition in genetics.
But it's deliberate, right? They're doing it just to be kind of...
No, because there's a lot of nuance and they have to capture that nuance and they use a word to mean something very specific, but just not how that word evolved to be used in other contexts. You know, like a syndrome means something different to a geneticist than to a non-geneticist physician.
And a superhero.
And to a physician. And
and also different to a fan of The Incredibles.
All right, well, let's go on with the news items. This one is interesting. I wrote about this on Science-Based Medicine. So a study came out looking at the relationship, if any, between the number of antigens that people get exposed to through vaccines and their risk of developing non-vaccine preventable diseases. Got it? So the question is, this is all about the too many too soon slogan that the anti-vaxxers came up with. The notion is, and this is total BS, is that vaccines overwhelm young children's, you know, immature immune systems, and that actually weakens their immune system and leaves them susceptible to other infectious diseases. So vaccines are bad. There's really not a lot of scientific plausibility to that. But researchers wanted to, which I think is fine. You know, some people are like, oh, it's, you know, the anti-vaxxers are controlling our research agenda. Not a lot, but I mean, it's the risk management is all about layers and layers of confidence, you know? So the idea that we're doing research to look for any, you know, possibility here, even if it's implausible, I think is fine. But what they did, this is a case control study. I know Karen knows what this is, but basically you take a group of people with the bad outcome, that's the case, and you compare them to a group of people without the bad outcome, that's the control group, right? Mm-hmm. And then you look and see, did they have anything previously that might correlate with the bad outcome? In this case, they took 193 subjects who had non-vaccine related infections and 751 subjects who did not have these non-vaccine related infections. And then they said, okay, well, how many antigens had they been exposed to in the first 2 years of life?
So these were all like baby vaccines.
Yeah, first 2 years of life. Yeah.
Okay.
And then, you know, if getting a lot of vaccines leaves you susceptible to other infections, and you would think that the case group, the group of people who had these other infections, would have had exposure to more vaccines in the past. That's the hypothesis. And the results were dead negative. There was no statistically significant difference between the two groups, which argues against the claim that vaccines weaken the immune system.
Mm-mm.
Now, this is a case control study, which means it's a retrospective study, and therefore it's not randomized, right? People weren't randomized to these two groups. They were assigned to these two groups based upon what had already happened to them. Did they have an infection or not?
Yeah, you can't really do a randomized study where you induce infections in people.
Yeah, well, that would kind of, you know, obviate the outcome. But all, yeah. The thing is, you can't randomize people to not getting vaccines because
exactly,
it's not ethical. Yeah. So we have to do this kind of research. And of course, because this is more correlational and not, you know, we're not randomizing people, you can't rule out that there are confounding factors. Mm-hmm. So like, for example, it's possible that people who don't get infections are different in other ways. Like maybe, for example, that they're just generally healthier than the people who did get infections. Does that make sense? So, but we don't know of any particular reason why the two groups would be different. We just can't rule out that there's some unknown difference because they're not randomization is what's supposed to take care of those differences. And yeah. So if they're not randomized and you just don't know. There could be confounding factors that were not being controlled for.
So it could just be that certain people happen to have stronger immune systems than other people.
That's probably true, but that shouldn't really be different. I mean, that could be different between the two groups, but that shouldn't negate the results because that shouldn't really determine whether or not they got vaccinated.
Right, because how would you even know that?
So you could claim that the group that had infections were both healthier and got more vaccines. That's the healthy user effect. And so
What does that mean then? I'm confused by that.
Yeah. So let's say that parents overall took better care of their kids, including giving them more vaccines. And the vaccines increased the number of infections they got. But the fact that their parents took better care of them decreased the number of infections that they got. And those two factors exactly cancel each other out. Now, that's a little far-fetched, but you could say that it is obscuring the signal if that were the case. But I don't think that that would be the case anyway, because actually parents who don't vaccinate their kids tend to have disposable income. You know, these are generally upscale people with disposable income.
Like educated women, right?
Yeah. And socioeconomic status is by far and away the most dominant factor in terms of determining healthy users, right? So if anything, it might go the other way. You can make a reasonable argument anyway that the kids who are less vaccinated are probably higher socioeconomic status and would be healthier in other ways. So I don't buy the healthy user argument. But the bottom line is we're speculating. We don't really know. But in any case, that's not a fatal flaw of this research. It just limits how certain we could be of the outcome. But there's an absence of a signal here that getting exposed to vaccines increases your risk of other, you know, non-vaccine related infections. And this is consistent with other research, which basically shows the same thing. So this is not an isolated study. We've looked at this another way. So in other words, there's other studies that, for example, compared children who got the standard vaccine schedule versus children who got alternative vaccine schedules, which delay or reduce the number of vaccines that they get. And the two groups were identical in terms of their overall health, number of neurological complications, et cetera. The only difference between those two groups was that the group with the alternative delayed vaccine schedule got more vaccine-preventable diseases. That's it. So they were left more vulnerable to the diseases that vaccines prevent, but they were not healthier in any other way. Every other way, they were the same. So again, doesn't seem that getting vaccinated on the full schedule has any health risks to it. So again, that research shoots down the anti-vax narrative that vaccines are somehow harming the kids or weakening their immune system. Also, in terms of the plausibility, the numbers tell a very powerful story. The primary article, Paul Offit ran the numbers, and Mark Crislip wrote about it for Science-Based Medicine and extended that as well. So, for example, if you got the complete sequence of hepatitis B vaccines, three vaccines, that would contain 30 micrograms of antigen. an antigen is the thing that actually responds to the immune system, right? So that triggers the immune system. It's a protein or a substance that is capable of triggering an immune response. That's an antigen. It's like one thing that an antibody would recognize and bind to. And that's what's in vaccines. That's what's provoking the immune response in vaccines. So you get all three hepatitis B vaccines, you get 30 micrograms of hepatitis B antigen. If you get infected with hepatitis B, you get 1,162 micrograms every hour for weeks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's many orders of magnitude more antigens from getting the illness than from getting the vaccine. So, you know, the vaccines actually have a very tiny amount of antigen overall.
Isn't it amazing that they work?
Yeah, well, it's because they're targeted. That's why that's why there are adjuvants. And, you know, that's why you get the boosters, which are timed to like produce these multiple stimulations of the immune system right at the right time to give the maximal response. You have to do all those things because we're trying to get a maximal immune response out of really a tiny amount of antigens.
Is Hep B in a child's course now?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I don't think it was when I was a kid because I just got my Hep B finished.
Yeah.
No, recently.
You could look at it another way. How many antigens do you think the average person gets exposed to over the course of a day or a week or a month?
You mean just
thousands,
in general?
Thousands a day, no?
Yeah, we must. There's so many germs that we're just like putting in our eyes and ears and nose and mouth all the time.
It's probably more like millions.
Wow.
And so...
That's amazing.
Yeah, the antigens that you get exposed to in the whole vaccine schedule. So the current vaccine schedule exposes kids to about 315 antigens by age two. 315. In those first 2 years of life, they would otherwise be exposed to millions of antigens. So this extra 315 is negligible. It's nothing. The idea that 315 antigens is overwhelming their immune system when the millions of antigens aren't is ridiculous. It has really no plausibility.
Well, what about the amount of antigen, Steve?
As again, that was the first point I made. The amount is tiny too. So the number of different ones is small. The amount, absolute amount, is small. And then also, if you look at the vaccine schedule, so again, one of the narratives of the anti-vaxxers is that as the vaccine schedule has been increasing over time, as we have been adding more and more vaccines to the schedule, all these horrible things are happening, right? Mm-hmm. And autism rates are going up. But as it turns out, while the number of vaccines has been increasing, the number of antigens has been decreasing.
Oh, because the vaccines are getting more efficient.
Yes. In 1980... Nice. The same schedule had over 3,000 vaccines. So the current schedule has about 1/10 the antigens as the vaccine schedule from the 1980s. The antigens have been steadily decreasing over time, even though the number of shots is increasing. So again, understanding the science tells a very different story than the very superficial inexpert narrative that the anti-vaxxers tell.
And yeah, I mean, following what you just said, then there should have been extraordinarily more cases of autism back in the 80s.
Yeah, right. If it is related. Yeah. But then they say, okay, well, it's not the antigens. It's the adjuvant. It's the mercury. Well, it's not the mercury. But okay, maybe it's the something else. It's the aluminum. Well, it's not the aluminum.
Yeah, the preservative.
But it's just whatever it is, it's something in the vaccines. I don't know what it is, but it's something about those damn vaccines. And when we'll just keep cycling through all the stuff until... And then we'll just go around again. Doesn't matter. It's got to be the vaccines.
It could possibly be the fact that vaccine schedules happen to be timed when a lot of early childhood disabilities come into play.
That's it.
Couldn't possibly be that.
Right.
And that's really, I mean, I think the hard thing is I'm always trying to like exercise empathy and look at this through the eyes of somebody who really is scared.
It's your first mistake.
Yeah, well, I do think it's important, you know, like, why is it that somebody would be so scared for their... I understand why they would be so scared for their children, but why is it that they would hold on to this so much? And so when you were using hepatitis B as an example, I think it's interesting, but at the same time, I feel like somebody would argue, especially if they're confused by the science, yeah, but my kid's probably never going to get hepatitis. There's a chance, but they might not get hepatitis. But something like chickenpox, like varicella, right? Yeah. Isn't that... Is there a massive difference similarly between the amount of antigen in the vaccine versus the amount of antigen that they'd be exposed to over the course of being in school?
If you read Mark Crislip's article, he goes through many, many diseases. And the exposure from all of the child, all of the vaccine preventable diseases is much greater than the vaccines themselves.
Yeah.
That was just one. I just pulled one example, but you could take any of
them. Yeah. Because
diphtheria,
that's
pertussis,
good. That's
whatever,
good. Because kids will get chickenpox. Like, that's the thing. Like, they're going to get it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if you don't vaccinate them, they're going to get that disease.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the thing that keeps occurring to me when I hear news like this, and, you know, there's just so much of it, of the benefits of vaccines. At what point does the science become truly actionable and unavoidable?
Yeah.
Well, it already is in a way. I mean, there are already – most school districts require vaccination. Many municipalities require vaccination. Like, I think that, you know, this is a small but vocal minority that's trying to undo a lot of the legislation that is actionable and exists based on the science.
Yeah, you're right. Obviously, nothing is 100% in science, and we continue to study. That's why I don't mind doing these kinds of studies, even though we don't really need them. But at some point, you cross the threshold where you could say, okay, we can all agree that this is the case enough to be actionable. And it's you know, worth pointing out that all of the industrialized nations have a similar vaccine schedule to us, and we're not actually the biggest. And the World Health Organization has reviewed all of this data. This is evidence-based. This is based upon evidence. They didn't just make it up. You know, the people who have the alternative vaccine schedules, they're just making it up, literally. They're just like, get rid of this one and spread these out some more. They're not basing it on published evidence.
It's a standard of care, right? The definition of the standard of care.
It's part of the standard of care. Yeah. Communities, behavior is also another part of it. But when there are published evidence-based guidelines, as we say, I often tell my residents, you have to know what those guidelines are. You don't have to follow them, but if you don't, you better have a damn good reason.
Yeah. They're otherwise, not suggestions.
Otherwise, you have to imagine defending yourself in a court of law when there was a negative outcome because you didn't follow the published guidelines. What was your reason for not doing so? And it can't be you weren't aware that they existed, or it can't just be that you just felt like it wasn't the right thing to do. I mean, you got to be able to defend yourself. If you said it didn't apply to this patient for this specific reason, okay, fine. Then you have a good reason. But, the people, the doctors promoting the alternative vaccine schedule have nothing. They really have nothing.
Yeah. And,
but it's just like any other pseudoscience, though.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they have nothing, and they're selling it on the same old tropes. It's on fear.
It's fear mongering, and they're gurus. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
don't trust the government. Don't trust what they told you. It's all like the beginnings of conspiratorial thinking. You know.
Yeah. And then they go full blown into conspiracy thinking. That's where it all heads. Absolutely. All right. Jay, can I get my lab-grown hamburger now or what?
Yay.
Steve, if it were up to me, I would be handing them out.
Yeah.
You know, as people walk by. You know, we talked about lab-grown meat, and you've heard about the crazy expensive lab-grown hamburgers in the past. You know, there's an update to this, which I was really excited when I saw something, because it's always like 5 years away, you know. Well, it's happening. It's happening. I'm not sure when we first mentioned this, but it was probably 4 or 5 years ago. So a few facts to fill your heads with. Lab-grown meat is also known as in vitro animal products or clean meat. So you'll hear it referred to that in the press. I think most people know it as lab-grown meat. But this field of science has been making steady progress, and one company is even claiming that the meat can be found in restaurants by the end of this year. So that's a pretty profound statement. So I was looking into the science behind lab-grown meat, just wanting to understand the process a little bit better. And it is pretty cool. So this is what they do. They take a biopsy of stem cells from a living animal. Now, there's many different kinds of stem cells that can be used. There's embryonic stem cells, adult stem cells, myosatellite cells, or myoblasts. So what they do is then they harvest them. They introduce a protein that promotes tissue. And then, you know, keep in mind the meat has to grow in three dimensions, right? It's not just growing on a surface. It has to grow out and up. So scientists had to come up with an edible substrate or scaffolding.
Like a scaffolding. Cool.
That you don't and can't remove.
Did they use peanut brittle?
Ew.
That could be something
else.
That would
be disgusting. That's pretty good. I don't want a hamburger peanut.
Now, of course, the substrate is edible as well.
Yeah.
What is it?
It's proteins. It's just different proteins.
Yeah.
And then it grows up, and it grow. And you know, the pictures that you see online, you know, I don't think that in the reactor where they're growing this is exactly what it looks like. But you always see the petri dish filled with hamburger meat.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that's the way they're growing it. I'm sure that there's other things that they're doing and other ways that it's like in different types of trays and stuff. But I just couldn't
really
get
big
any
petri
imagery.
Dishes.
Yeah, aren't they having to grow like the pure muscle tissue and then the blood vessel tissue and the fat tissue like separately, and then they just grind it all up together?
What I do know is that the tissue is coming out as pure protein, so they have to mix in some animal fat.
Yeah, yeah. Otherwise, it would taste terrible, and it would be like gray.
It doesn't have the texture and everything unless there's some fat in there. Now, they might be trying to make it so it's growing the protein and the fat at the same time.
And it needs the blood. Like, it actually needs the vessels.
That's not blood. That fluid that comes out of steak is not actually blood. It's a protein that's
myoglobin?
Inside the tissue.
Myoglobin.
Yeah, it's I was just I did a story recently about Impossible Burger. So that's completely different because it's not plant-based, but they use heme, the actual protein heme, which is found in blood, and that's what gives it that really amazing kind of meaty flavor, that umami flavor. Without heme, it does not taste like meat.
Every time I hear someone say umami, I keep thinking someone's like, oh, mommy. Like,
so umami.
So here I've got myoglobin, iron and oxygen binding protein found in the muscle tissue of vertebrates.
Yeah, and also look up heme. It's iron and porphyrin. It's a hemoprotein. It's in hemoglobin, obviously.
So, Jay, they still need to add animal fat, though. I mean, so they're not quite there yet with a totally not animal-based hamburger.
Well, this is animal-based. The lab burger is animal-based. It's a punch biopsy of muscle.
It is. Like, they you know, when they're picking the animal tissue that they harvest, you know, they're picking it from the healthiest animal that they can find. And they can reuse those cultures for a long time. You know what I mean? So they're doing it. They just have to add in, you know, other animal product to give it the flavor of a hamburger. I mean, like, you want to eat a hamburger.
Hamburger has all of that in it. It has muscle and fat in it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind. Yeah. I wouldn't mind if the seed of the burger was, you know, a little animal protein. I mean, I'm sure some vegans would have a big problem with that, but I think that's you know, I think that's good enough if the tiny little seed of animal protein, but if they're also then throwing in animal fat and other animal heat, it's like, then it's like, well, it's
hey, what
it's,
if they're growing the animal fat?
Yeah, they're growing
as well,
that
Bob,
too.
You know?
It's still in vitro.
Grow the animal fat,
but Bob,
I'm not sure that they are though. I gotta look it up.
But eventually they'll be able to. But Bob, I would recommend that you try. I mean, I know this is completely off base, but try an Impossible Burger. There's no animal protein in it at all. And it tastes like a burger.
That's impossible.
It's amazing.
Well, how does it taste? If it's all plant-based, how does it taste? I'm sure it tastes probably good, but is it really
like,
wow?
No, it tastes
like,
amazing.
Wow, it tastes just
it tastes
like
better
a
than a hamburger. It tastes better than a hamburger. And I am from Texas.
But is it hamburgery?
Yes. The heme makes it hamburgery. It even bleeds. Okay. You can cook it medium.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, I highly recommend
it. I'll check it out.
It's really good.
They even sell it on the East Coast.
Yeah, so I look at it like, you know, if you consider the amount of energy it takes to grow even one cow to where you would harvest it. I'd imagine, you know, if we had extreme efficiency in the manufacturing process, this could be a profound upgrade from the way we do it today. You know, just from an efficiency of energy and materials used. Now, of course, there's going to be tons of hurdles here that have to be jumped over for lab-grown meat to integrate into society. I mean, there's regulatory factors. I keep reading about how the regulations are going to be really difficult. It's a new industry. The infrastructure doesn't exist yet. And the experts are saying if anything slows down the rollout of lab-grown meat, it's going to be government regulations. And it could slow it down by years. Mm-hmm. Some industry leaders are saying it could take a huge delay on the whole thing. Now, recent studies showed that 1/3 of Americans are okay eating lab-grown meat as a replacement for traditional farm meat. I think once people try it and found out that the quality was there, that it would be relatively quick. I mean, it's not so much, in my opinion, that it was grown in a lab. I mean, if anything, you'd think there's a lot of things that we just discussed that would make you feel better about it being grown in the lab. But come on, if it tastes good, you know, and if it's better for the environment.
Yeah, you're right. But there absolutely will be a Frankenburger movement, you know, just because you're saying if everyone's rational and they base their decisions on the evidence and the reality, yeah, wouldn't that be nice? But you know that there's going to be a segment of people who don't.
Yeah.
And they'll come up with some reason. It causes autism. Frankenburgers cause autism. There you go.
Yeah, of course it'll be there. The question is it going to have a significant impact?
Yeah,
it's only
a question of how – of magnitude. I also love pointing out the fact that people say, oh, we need to go all organic, and we could do that if we stop what? Eating meat. Because you can't produce enough food organically, right, to feed the
world.
No. They said, and they argue that, well, we could if we didn't, if we just were vegetarians and we didn't have any meat, because the meat is where all, as you pointed out, is where there's a huge inefficiency. But the point that they miss is, where are you going to get all the cow manure to fertilize your organic farms?
Oh, interesting. I forgot that.
Yeah, right? It doesn't work out. So
you got to use synthetic fertilizer.
You have to use synthetic fertilizer, which is not
now
organic.
Now it's not organic. Yeah.
Right. There's no way. We couldn't feed the world with cow manure no matter what. It just can't work. If you do an analysis of where is all the nitrogen coming from in our food, it's not sustainable for it to be coming from animals. You know, we need artificial fertilizer.
Well, and I mean, there's so many other. It's like, if we wanted to go all organic, first of all, there wouldn't be enough food. And second of all, we would be so subjected to infection. Like, there would be droughts. There would be like crop failures, famine all the time. If everybody was relying on only plants and only plants that weren't genetically modified, there'd be like, oh, there's just no potatoes this year. Have fun.
Yeah.
No potato, right?
Yeah.
Right?
It's like, okay. Like, we need to rely on the science that keeps our food healthy and keeps it safe and keeps it from, having these massive seasonal problems. So
All organic is crazy. That's like saying I got the best porn ever, but we gotta all use 14.4 modems. Like, why do you want to step back?
It's a weird analogy, but
that's a great analogy.
Right. I mean, there's no reason to go organic anyway, but the math doesn't work
right.
out. But not only that, the thing is, you're right, Kara. But and when you really push them against the wall, they go, but we need to reduce our population anyway. So they're basically saying,
right.
No, seriously, it's like always part.
I've heard it.
Part of the agenda is, let's switch to organic and half the planet starves, and that will really reduce our footprint on the environment. But
I agree we need to reduce our population anyway, but not that way. Like, I just think we need to be more mindful about reproduction.
All we need to do is improve the quality of life, especially for women, and that will absolutely take care of the population explosion.
Yes, education, access to birth control, all those things, and the population goes naturally.
All we have to do is make people's lives better. That's what we call a win-win situation. We don't have to starve them to death.
Jesus,
I love
Christ.
It.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, Lisa Mattresses.
Yeah, so I told you guys I got my Lisa mattress mailed to me, and now I have my son sleeping on it.
Oh, his big boy bed.
And he wakes up with a youthful vigor.
Right.
Yeah, guys, Lisa is an innovative direct-to-consumer online mattress brand. It's also socially conscious. For every 10 mattresses that they sell, they donate one to a shelter through their 110 program. And they also plant one tree for every mattress sold and donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes. I love that.
And my favorite part is the three premium foam layers. There's a 2-inch Avena foam top layer. Then there's the 2-inch memory foam middle layer, which is my favorite. And then there's the 6-inch dense core support foam layer.
And we want you to try a Lisa mattress in your home for 100 nights risk-free. It's available in the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, and Germany online with free shipping. And it's 100% American made. Ships compressed in a box right to your door. Jay will attest to that. Or you can go ahead and try it at the Lisa Dream Gallery in Soho, New York City, and Virginia Beach, and over 80 West Elm stores nationwide. Get $100 off when you go to leesa.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, Bob, tell us about how much more awesome driverless cars are going to be soon.
So Stanford University researchers made a breakthrough in using lasers to see what's around the next corner, literally the next corner, potentially making future autonomous cars seem downright prescient. So this was recently published in the journal Nature. And now this doesn't necessarily seem like an obvious advance, right? It kind of reminds me of a topic I discussed way back in episode 417. I talked about using light to see through walls. It's like, well, wait, how does that even work? Whereas that technique used low-power Wi-Fi signals, this technique uses rapid laser pulses to image objects where there's no direct line of sight. So the key is multiply scattered light. You got to scatter light multiple times to make this technique work. So the researchers' lab had try to visualize this. They had two separated walls at right angles to each other. So one wall hit a rabbit, a toy rabbit, and the laser could not see the rabbit. There was no direct line of sight because the wall was in the way. But if the light was scattered off the farther wall, that it would then hit the rabbit that was hidden, and then that light. So that's scatter event number one. Then the light would scatter off the rabbit, and then scatter off the wall again, and then back to the laser. So you got the light kind of doing this kind of circuitous path thing, lots of scattering, but eventually some light gets back to the sensors that are waiting there. Now, as you'd imagine, there's not much light coming back to the single from one single laser pulse. I mean, it's literally a handful of photons, so there's not much there. So how, you know, what could you really do with that? And then that's where a cool acronym comes in, SPAD. SPAD, that stands for a single photon avalanche diode. This diode is a cool bit of tech that greatly magnifies or avalanches, apparently, those few photons to create a signal that can then be expertly enhanced. And that's not even the breakthrough part. That's just like cool, but that's not the real excellent piece here. To do that, to enhance such meager light, you need some really good software algorithms, and they have them. And what that does is it looks at the paths of the photons, and then it recombines them and then create a much, much sharper image. And that's not even the real breakthrough here. People have been doing that for a while. They may be doing that little part of it really well, but the real tour de force and breakthrough here has to do with the unprecedented computational economy and efficiency the researchers have attained in dealing with that image once it comes back and processing it. David Lindell, who's at the Stanford Computational Imaging Lab and the co-author of the paper, he said that a substantial challenge in non-line-of-sight imaging is figuring out an efficient way to recover the 3D structure of the hidden object from the noisy environments. I think the big impact of this method is how computationally efficient it is, and it is. The bottom line is that the image processing that used to take hours, they can do now in seconds. Or even a second. It's incredibly, incredibly fast. That's how efficient they've made this thing. But of course, there are still some challenges here. Their algorithms are super fast, but scanning the environment itself is not. That part of the process can take from 2 minutes to an hour, depending on, you know, light and things in the environment. So that's kind of like the weak link, pretty weak at this point still. And this is made even more problematic by the complex, you know, how complex the outdoor environment is, you know, outside of the lab, how bright the daylight is. And so the laser will have to be bright enough, but not so bright that it basically blinds everybody outside of the car. So you got to be careful. But of course, on the other hand, that such a device could come in handy. So once perfected, though, what are we talking about? There could be lots of applications. First and foremost is autonomous cars. As we've been stressing, many autonomous cars already use a form of LIDAR, which is light detection and ranging. And this process uses pulse lasers to see what objects are in the car's immediate environment. Kind of important when the computer's driving the car, obviously. So, but that kind of LIDAR is exactly what this new process uses. So they believe that when they implement this, it should be very, very smooth. Just basically load the new software and the new algorithms, and it should be able to handle this well. Of course, there's going to be some hardware upgrades required as well. So we already know how safe autonomous cars can be under computer control. Imagine how safe they can be if they literally can see around corners. So it looks pretty promising. But you can also, beyond autonomous cars, you can imagine using this in microscopy. Or how about this? How about rescue scenarios where people are hidden under rubble? You know, mm-hmm. You just shine the light inside, get all the reflections, and you could rebuild images of things that you can't see, that are not in your direct line of sight. Somebody could be buried under there, obviously. How about aerial vehicles that could use it when they're looking through foliage or buildings, could use this technology as well?
Or what if you drop something under the couch?
Don't
want to bend over, you know, you could just pull out something there.
Pull out my LIDAR.
Completely reasonable use.
Sure. I'm all for lazy uses of high tech.
Bob, look at duct tape, you know?
Yeah.
What?
Okay.
Jay's trying to win the non sequitur award.
No, I'm not. Look at all duct tape was created by NASA to cover a hole up in a spacecraft. Look at what we do with it today. We f-ing hold houses together with it.
That's true. Yeah.
That's true. It is an amazing, amazing piece of matter.
Yeah, just read The Martian. You'll learn all about the uses of duct tape.
Oh my God, look at Mythbusters. They put them on a great episode. They put them on an island with unlimited supplies of duct tape, and that's it. And they what they did with that was amazing. They literally like lived off of it, caught animals, made tents and hammocks, and they built a boat and sailed off the island. So duct tape is awesome. Preaching to the choir, sister. And finally, robots. Robots could use this to detect people coming around the corner or ultimately to find people hiding from them during the robopocalypse.
Good. So when there finally is a robot uprising, they'll be even deadlier than we
Yes, they can find us even faster.
All right. I mean, it just would I'm make scared. Somebody want to like get wasted on opioids and forget the whole thing.
Oh boy, nice segue. I sense a segue coming up.
Oh yeah, that was a good one.
Who's talking about opioids today?
Took me a second. Yeah, Karen, I'm talking about opioids today. All right, so big study done. It was published in JAMA. It's called Effective Opioid versus Non-Opioid Medications on Pain-Related Function in Patients with Chronic Back Pain or Hip or Knee Osteoarthritis Pain. This was information that was taken – actually, it was published really recently, like March 6th of this month. Information that was taken from the SPACE randomized trial. SPACE stands for Strategies for Prescribing Analgesics – Comparative Effectiveness Trial.
Wow.
I have a question for you, Steve. In the psychology work that I've been doing a lot on like psychometrics, I learned the difference, which I never knew before, between effectiveness trials and efficacy trials. Does it hold for medical research as well, that effectiveness research is real world research and efficacy is like incredibly stringent laboratory, like non-real world settings?
Yes. Efficacy is basically, does it work? And, and effectiveness is it useful in the real world?
Okay, cool. So yeah, this was an effectiveness trial, and that's important to remember because it really does speak to how the methods of this trial worked. So it was a randomized clinical trial, but it was not a blind trial. So that's important to remember, mostly for exactly what we were talking about earlier in the show, ethical reasons. But basically, not until now, this is so crazy to me to think about, not until now has there been a study that put opioids head-to-head with other pain meds. Mm-hmm. We've seen opioids compared to placebo, and we've seen all these different pain meds compared to placebo, but we've never looked at, all things being equal, if they're given an opioid or like Tylenol, like some other kind of analgesic, how do they fare? And the outcome of this study is that they fared no better having taken the opioids than taking things like Tylenol. So here, let's dig into it. I thought I was going to get a gasp from you guys, but nobody responded.
No, I'm totally gasp. I read the article, but yeah, the one thing I didn't
like about the
reporting.
Are you listening?
I'm here.
Okay.
One thing I didn't like about the reporting, though, of the study was that they always try to exaggerate the impact of the new information.
Yeah.
And they were saying, and this is, I think, probably largely my bias as a neurologist, because the kind of stuff that we treat, we really don't use opioids. And they were making it seem like, oh yeah, opioids are first line treatment for pain. Really? When are they first line?
Yeah. Other I think than it's because like, they're talking about chronic pain and they're relating it to the opioid quote unquote epidemic.
Yeah. But for chronic pain, especially, we don't use opioids for like, surgical, traumatic, short-term, terminal pain, whatever.
But yeah, palliative care.
For chronic pain is like the category where like we are really cautious about opioids, and it's absolutely not first line. But again, that's partly my bias as a neurologist. But we're at, I think, one end of the spectrum because we treat neuropathic pain too, which is especially unresponsive to opioids. And in fact, opioids make it worse. And the downsides of, I think, chronic opioid use are probably most felt with the kinds of things that we treat. So this is not universal in medicine. Let me just say that.
And I think that's important to point out too, because I think sometimes we go to the worst place because we're so used to reading like this really intensive reporting. We often don't read news articles about things are going well today.
Yeah,
we read news articles like pain clinic shut down for unethical, or illegal prescriptions because things
Those
like
are
that,
outliers.
Unfortunately, they're outliers. but they do happen and they take the headlines. I'm glad that you actually made that point, because that is an important point. But so what they did is they looked at pain-related function between two groups of people over a course of 12 months. And they divided this into two groups, like I just said, and half of the group got opioid treatment, things like morphine, Vicodin, and oxycodone, and half of the group got non-opioid analgesics like NSAIDs, Tylenol, ibuprofen, even lidocaine, like topicals. And the thing that's a little bit complicated about this is that the real distinction here is that the patients were randomized, so that's very important. But beyond that, they were given as much drug as was necessary based on their treatment requirements. So they just couldn't take the other class of drugs. So if they started as a non-opioid drug, if they had to switch from Tylenol to ibuprofen, their doctors helped them do that. If they needed to up their dosage, their doctors helped them do that. So it's really, really not very controlled once we get into how the individuals were treated. But that said, the opioid group only took opioids for pain, and the non-opioid group only took non-opioids for pain. And that was maintained throughout the 12 months of the study. So that's an important thing to notice. The author and her co-author said that they were, you know, interested in looking at this because of the opioid crisis. And when you look into the background of that, it's a pretty rough thing that's going on right now. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say that about 115 Americans die every day from overdose deaths linked to prescription opioids, not just heroin. So that's specifically things like oxycodone and hydrocodone and morphine, if they can get their hands on it. Again, that trial, the SPACE trial, enrolled patients that were treated at the VA in Minneapolis. So this whole trial took place there. The patients had different kinds of pain, back pain, hip pain, or knee pain. They were required to have it for at least 6 months, and they were only enrolled if that pain was bad enough to, you know, cause an interference in their daily lives. This was all self-report. So they were looking at, they had, you know, a pretty good understanding of what these patients were taking. They took good records, and then they just compared that to a pain scale. So the scale was from 0 to 10. After the 12 months, the opioid group reported an average score of 4. So their pain, these are chronic pain sufferers, remember. So they said that they were experiencing a 4 out of 10 of pain after taking opioids for 12 months. And the non-opioid group said that they had an average score of, they reported on average a score of 3.5. Now, that's not a significant difference when you actually run the statistics. It is, you know, lower, but it's not statistically significantly lower. But even so, that does show that the opioid group did not fare any better. Let's see. Over the course of the year, 41% of the people who were taking the opioids said that they saw a 30% improvement when you looked at their scores from the pretest and the post-test. 30% improvement. Non-opioid group, 54% improvement. That was a significant difference. Let's see. The life kind of interference ratings were about the same. People who took opioids said that their pain interfered with their work, their sleep, their mood, and their life enjoyment at a 3.4 out of 10. The non-opioid group said a 3.3 out of 10. So again, no significant difference there. Same here, no significant difference that after 12 months, 59% of the opioid takers and 61% of the non-opioid takers said that they had an improvement of at least 30% in pain reduction or in life, general life satisfaction from pain reduction. They also looked at, you know, other kinds of side effects or health-related life qualities like fatigues, headaches, depression, sexual function. They didn't see any sort of difference between the two groups. But one thing that was highly significant between the two groups was that the opioid group, as expected, had way more side effects. They had more medication-related symptoms, obviously, because we see lots of problems with opioid use. We see a low energy, you know, hard time with focus and other kinds of things. We see, obviously, aside from the addictive nature of it, we also see things like really bad constipation from taking opioids. There's a lot of bad stuff that can happen. But hospitalizations and emergency room visits were similar. And here's an interesting thing, as were rates of drug misuse. But what I'm assuming and maybe it's an unfair assumption, that what they're looking at by drug misuse, because they only looked over the course of the 12 months, they didn't look at, utilizing drugs when they were not prescribed. I'm assuming they're talking here about taking more than they were prescribed, overuse, which is quite common, overuse. When you are in pain and the dose that you're prescribed is not getting rid of the pain, that's a quite common problem, is that if I just take a little more, maybe I'll feel a little better. So I don't know, super interesting study. Obviously, it would be nice if it were a perfect study, like we always say on the show. It'd be nice if it were a double-blind, placebo-controlled study where everybody was matched perfectly with their demographic information and they took the exact same dosage on the exact same time of day. But again, this was an efficiency trial, not an efficacy trial. And interestingly, based on the limitations that were reported, based on how clearly this research was reported, it does seem to be the case that for at least what you mentioned before, Steve, not acute pain, not surgical pain, and not palliative, terminal pain, but for chronic pain, kind of osteopathic or osteoarthritic pain, NSAIDs, other types of opioids, other types of pain relievers, they work just as well as opioids, and they don't have, they have their own kinds of side effects, like intestinal problems and things like that, but they don't have nearly the, I think, intensity of side effects. And also, they don't carry the same risk of addiction, which is a big problem.
And you can't sell them on the street for $10 a pill.
Exactly. Now, the problem, though, is that when we look at the opioid crisis, sort of the narrative that we see a lot is post-surgical pain or acute pain. Somebody will come in after having their wisdom teeth removed, or they'll break their back and they'll get opiates as treatment post-surgical or post-accident. And then once they were supposed to step down, the pain comes back. Then they might move over to heroin or some other form of the drug on the street when they no longer have the prescription. And that becomes a chronic abuse and misuse. But we're talking about people who are already in that chronic place.
Yeah. And to be clear, I mean, opioids are effective and they, when used properly, and they can play a role even in chronic pain, but it has to be very highly selective and monitored, et cetera. The big problem from a practical point of view, as a prescriber with opioids, is that they're really effective short term and horrible long term.
Yeah. And it's really hard to maintain a relationship with a patient. They don't always come back. You can't always keep an
eye
on
that.
Why
you have to have a contract with the patient, right? You have to say, I'm never going to replace lost or stolen medication. I'm never going to give you early prescriptions. So it's up to you. And this is how many you're going to get. And that's it. And you're going to not call it, at 3 a.m. and try to get the resident on cover, to give you more, whatever. And if you do
Have that happen?
Yes. Pretty much every patient that I prescribe, I shouldn't say everyone, but it's very common for patients when you first start these prescriptions to test you at least once. And you have to hold the line. And pain clinics literally have a contract. Like, the patient signs a piece of paper that is a contract about how it's going to work. And if they violate the contract, they're banned. No narcotics. Yeah. That's it.
Do you have to step down like you would with benzodiazepines? Is part of the prescription to do a step down at the end, or can you stop?
Depends on dose duration. But if they've been using it for a long time, you usually have to wean them off. You don't want them to go to withdrawal. Withdrawal could be bad. But the thing is, it's so psychologically addicting. And then once they get that, that euphoria of they don't care about the pain, because pain could make you feel so dysphoric, and the narcotics take that away, and it basically spoils you for everything else. But then, of course, then you get addicted to it, and tolerant, meaning that it's less effective over time. So by necessity, you have to increase the dose to get that same effect.
Yeah, so it's not
even
working anymore, but you're just chasing what
exactly,
you used to feel.
Exactly. And then you get chronically, it increases your pain, right? It lowers your pain threshold. It makes you feel dysphoric at baseline. And so 3-6 months in, you have somebody who is in more pain than they were before, and now they're addicted. It's like the worst thing you could do.
Ruin your life.
Yeah, you've just So it's like a horrible way to manage chronic pain. Unless you're doing it very carefully, but it's like the last resort. I have very, very few patients who I would do that with. And we know now it actually can cause a chronic neuropathic pain syndrome. You have an opioid overuse chronic neuropathic pain syndrome. That's a thing unto itself.
Could you imagine? It's just a terrible drug
long term is the bottom line.
But unfortunately, what's probably not very uncommon, or maybe I'm wrong, and you probably have much better insights about this, is that if you are an osteopathic surgeon, or you're doing something where you see these patients and you don't really do much follow up with them, and you know that they're in crushing pain after their surgery, and you're like, okay, well, yeah, an opiate is going to help you. Here's your opiate. Goodbye and good luck. Like that's what is so worrisome.
Well, that I agree. And sometimes that's exactly where the problem has. It's in the transition from, say, subacute pain to chronic pain when you get to that 6 to 8 weeks. And that's often where the patient's transitioning out of the surgical care, right? Because that's done.
Yeah.
You know, they've healed, they're good, but no one really has adequately managed that transition, and they're in the hands of somebody else. And then, then the patient says, this is the drug that I'm getting, and this is what I need, and they'll just hunt around to find somebody who will give it to them. Patients, when they're drug seeking, will doctor shop,
Yeah.
So if 95% of the doctors are doing exactly what they should do, they go to ERs, get temporary prescriptions. They'll find somebody. They'll work the system.
Pain clinics.
They get very good at working the system, and it takes years of experience, from a clinician to recognize, all the red flags and to learn how to shut it down. It's not easy.
And then, unfortunately, beyond that, once they've exhausted the doctor shopping, there's still the option to find it on the street or to find a non prescription version, because, of course, heroin is also an opioid. It kind of does the same thing. It's just a different drug.
Yep. And if you're trying to monitor the patient's total use, they go across state lines. Yeah, they're out of the system now, because it's mostly the tracking is state by state. So anyway, unfortunately, there's too many cracks in the infrastructure. But the thing is, I had the same conversation 20 years ago, 30 years ago, that this cycles. I'm sure we'll crack down on it, and then things will get better. And then 10 years from now, people will be complaining, we're under treating pain. We're letting people needlessly suffer. Yeah. We need to loosen, and then we'll cycle back, and then in 20, 30 years, we'll be back where we are now. And that seems to be what's happened. So we need a systemic change, not just the short-term fix, because otherwise it just keeps going around in circles. It's a tough problem.
I don't want to say the near future, but do you think they'll have a way to fix the things that chemically change in the brain when you become addicted to a drug?
The ultimate solution may be finding pain medications that are more effective, that do not have the downsides of narcotics.
Yeah.
But we're limited by the receptors that evolution has made for us, right? We can't change the biochemistry of the brain. We have to work with the material that we have. So it remains to be seen what the limits of evolution are in terms of what pharmacologically we can interact with. And then we may need to use other methods, like actually using electrical or magnetic stimulation of the brain, so that way we're not limited by the pharmacological receptors that are available to us. We can hack the brain directly. So I'm hoping we'll technology our way out of this problem, but we're not there yet. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, last week I played this noisy. Because it's so short, you'll get it twice.
How about a Tesla coil? It's a Tesla coil.
Oh, yeah, it's a little, you're right, it's a little electrically poppy sounding. Oh, it's a toaster being dropped into a bathtub.
It reminds me of some sound effect in a sci-fi movie, but I know that's not it.
Oh, I think I know what you think it is.
I bet you do.
War of the Worlds,
you mean?
Oh,
War of the Worlds, yeah. Okay. This is the 1990s version.
I like that movie.
A little bit. Yeah, it wasn't bad.
I loved the Martians. They were menacing, the way they were walking around.
I needed more of that, a little bit more. Okay, so this was a fun one for a couple of reasons. One, I got lots of guesses. And again, I always love enjoying reading the crazy stuff that people think it is. A lot of times people are just sending me stuff that's ridiculous. But I'll start with the worst guess from last week. Now, when I say the worst guess, I'm not trying to insult anyone. The worst could also be the funniest. Take it in a good frame of mind, okay? This was sent in by David. To Who's That Noisy was the noise a bullwhip with accompanying crack from the sonic boom. Nope, that was not a sonic boom. That would be a much more high-pitched, cracky kind of noise.
You're a cracky kind of noise.
Yeah, cracky. And then, so I have a notable that I'd like to mention simply because the person gave the best description of what's going on, which I will read. But I had two winners. One of them was named Bob, and the other one is Brian Salai. So Bob got it first, and he said it's the barking dog exothermic chemical reaction. That is correct. I will tell you exactly what the barking dog experiment is. Brian guessed it perfectly. He guessed it and named the video that I got it from. So, but they both won because this was a difficult one, and I'll tell you why. Now, let me go back down to Harold Girdlestone, who gave me a fantastic explanation of what this is, and here's what Harold said. This sounds like a reaction of carbon disulfide, CS2, with nitrous oxide, N2O, in a tube.
Of course.
He says, I followed the YouTube channel. So in barking dog experiment, carbon disulfide, CS2, and it's a liquid, and N2O, a gas, are mixed with water. The chemicals are added into a large tube, covered, and mixed. The longer the tube, the deeper the note of the bark. The carbon disulfide evaporates during the mixing process, allowing it to react with the N2O, which is an oxidant, while in the same gaseous phase. After the chemicals have been mixed well, the cover is removed and the gas is ignited with a flame. The reaction also generates a bright flash of light that travels down the tube, which was used for photography before things like flash bulbs were invented. How about that? Thanks, guys. Don't worry about changing your clocks this weekend. It'll probably happen automatically. Wow, Harold, great description. I loved it. Now, in this experiment, the reason why we're getting not just a single bark noise, but we're getting kind of a womp, womp, womp kind of noise, that's because this was the barking dog experiment in a U-tube for YouTube. You get what I'm saying? It's in a tube the shape of a U, and they specifically made it for YouTube. So the scientists thought that that was funny, and I'll play the sound for you one more time so now you can think about what I told you and hear it. These scientists enjoy passing time doing the barking dog experiment in all different kinds of cylinders and shapes and sizes and everything. And this was their favorite one. This one was, you know, gave them the most unique sound. Loved it. Awesome noisy. I really appreciate it. I have a brand new noisy. This was sent in by Jeremy Kerwin.
That's a J after Mexican food.
Yeah.
So if you know what that is, or you think you know what it is, or if you had anything cool that you heard this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right, let's move on, guys. Let's go on with science or fiction.
Woo!
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. So we haven't mentioned this on the show yet, but I had a power outage at my home last night, Wednesday, right in the middle of recording the show. Boom, no power because we had the snowstorm, this nor'easter. And I was able to recover the file, thankfully, so I didn't lose that first 25 minutes or so of recording that we did. But we had to, you know, I didn't get my power back till 3 a.m, so we had to reschedule. Now we're finishing the show the next night on Thursday night. So I, you know, you guys had an extra day to catch wind of these science or fiction.
Yeah. No, I didn't even think about that. And also didn't try.
I was thinking of updating them. I was thinking of updating them, but I figured, nah, you guys, I'm making you come in another night. I'll take it easy on you. So you have an extra chance of having caught wind of these.
As soon as Steve's power went out, I get a text message from him, and it's FFFUUUUUCCCCKKKKK.
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Item number one. A new study finds that couples have a highly accurate sense of when their partner is sad or depressed. Item number two. A newly published forensic analysis concludes that bones found in Nikumaroro Island are very likely those of Amelia Earhart. And item number three, a new genetic analysis suggests that oxygenic photosynthesis evolved a billion years earlier than thought, near the beginning of life about 3.6 billion years ago. So, Bob, since you thought to take advantage of your extra day, I'll let you go first.
Oh, damn.
Did it help?
I knew I should have kept quiet.
Apparently not.
It did not help. Couples have a highly accurate sense of when their partner is sad or depressed. It's, God, that can't be true. But maybe that's why you're putting it there. So let's look at the other ones. Amelia Earhart found the bones. It's about time we found some solid evidence. Yeah, I do remember they did have some clues of where she potentially could have been. So maybe they did find her bones and miscategorize them. I don't know. But it's that's definitely possible. Photosynthesis evolved a billion years earlier. That's a huge, huge increase. Huge, baby. That's just like a billion, really, you know, 100 million years, maybe 50 million, but a billion. That would be so interesting. Yeah, I think you're trying to pull a fast one with this couples thing yeah, number one, I'm going to say that knowing that your partner's sad or depressed, that's got to be false. That's fiction.
Okay, Kara.
I like the Amelia Earhart bones. I hope it's true. It seems really cool. And yeah, same with Bob. I feel like I remember hearing like whispers of maybe we found them and we just need to do more work. So maybe this one is science. I think in terms of which one is the fiction, I'm really torn between going with Bob. It's just that one's so simple. And it's like, I don't know, psychology kind of tells me that one should be, that it should be true that partners are attuned to their partner's emotional state. Like even sometimes more than like people are attuned to their own emotional state because they have all these little like micro kind of behaviors. And then this idea of the photosynthesis evolving earlier than thought. I mean, that doesn't surprise me, but yeah, 3.6 billion years earlier than we thought, like, or not earlier, but 3.6 billion years ago, which is like, I don't know, that's right when life first came online. But then again, life came online as archaea, right? Which was photosynthetic, wasn't it? Like it was blue-green algae, I thought, was earliest life. It would need to be photosynthetic unless it was just chemosynthetic or not even synthetic at all. Maybe it's just – no. I don't know. Ah, now I'm confusing myself. I'm going to go with Bob on this. Bob, I'm going with you. I think that one G-W-B. Is
– GWB.
Yeah. It bums me out that it's fiction, but I think it might be.
Yeah, right.
And J.
Okay. So having quite a bit of experience in relationships, I made a funny observation about relationships. The vast majority of them fail.
Oh, yeah.
Think about
truth.
It. Truth. Right? I mean, by orders of magnitude, they fail.
Also, Jay, do you know what the number one predictor of attraction is?
What's that?
Proximity.
No. Yep. Propinquity.
Mm-hmm.
Propinquity. Great word.
Propinquity is the proper term. Yeah.
There you go. Propinquity. That should be a what's the word next week.
So, I mean, this one seems to make a lot of sense being the fiction because I think that you know, of course, again, last week, Steve hit us over the head with like anecdotes and don't use your own anecdotes. And your anecdotes suck and you suck and you know, information and all this stuff. But my anecdotes have taught me that, I think people misread each other a lot, even in someone that you're in a relationship with, you're in a routine. You know, if you have kids, how would you recognize depression in a couple with people that have to have kids when it's so hard to raise kids? It's hard. It's a lot of work. I'm doing dishes and cooking and cleaning the same exact 4 square feet of floor all day, every day. You know what I mean?
And so sometimes you don't even care.
Yeah. And, you know, to be really honest, like, you know, I've hidden my depression from people I've been in relationships with just to not affect the relationship and hurt them as well. You know, it's kind of like, let me just deal with it on my own and not wear it on the outside so much. So I think that one is the fiction. I don't even need to go into the other two. I You know, finding Amelia Earhart's bones, sure. You know, nothing surprises me about biology and photosynthesis, you know, 3.6 billion years earlier, or no, it was 3.6 billion years ago instead of it being, it's a billion years earlier. Okay. You know, they found proof of that. I could see that. But this one about the relationship, definitely the fiction.
Right. Okay. So let's take these in reverse order then. You all agree on the third one. A new genetic analysis suggests that oxygenic photosynthesis evolved a billion years earlier than thought, near the beginning of life about 3.6 billion years ago. You all think this one is science. Kara, I think all of you, I think, missed the key word in here.
Oh, uh-huh.
This was confusing. Oxygenic photosynthesis, because there is anoxygenic photosynthesis that doesn't produce oxygen.
Crap. So
this one is science. But again, the genetic analysis suggests, this isn't proof, and the type of genetic analysis they did was they looked at the genes necessary for oxygenic photosynthesis and then tried to reverse evolve them, right? Reverse engineer them, saying, okay, when would these have had to evolve and how long would it have taken them to evolve? And they calculated that it would have been a lot older than we think oxygenic photosynthesis evolved. The other line of evidence that we used to determine when that happened was basically looking at rocks and seeing when did the oxygen start to fill up the atmosphere. And that was more like 2.6 billion years ago, right? So a billion years later. So this, I think that, you know, this analysis is not ironclad. There's a lot of assumptions in here about the mutation rates, et cetera, that, you know, there's a lot of error bars. The error bars on this are huge. So I wouldn't hang my hat on this. That's why I just said suggests, because it did. The genetic analysis does suggest this timeline, but this is far from ironclad, and does conflict with other lines of evidence. Although, you know, it's possible that oxygenic photosynthesis did evolve earlier, but there just weren't that many organisms total that were producing oxygen. So they kind of simmered along until they really became popular. And then the oxygen filled up the atmosphere, right? Or there may be something else wrong with the geological evidence. But this is, again, when we're trying to reconstruct things that happened this far in the past, you need the convergence of multiple lines of evidence. You're never going to get to a reliable answer from any one line of evidence. This is just one line, and it's not supported by older lines of evidence. So we have to take that into consideration. But it is interesting, you know, that when you look at it genetically, maybe it evolved earlier than we thought. Okay, let's go back to number two. A newly published forensic analysis concludes that bones found at Nkumaroro Island are very likely those of Amelia Earhart. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yay!
The one that I thought that you guys would have heard in the last 24 hours, because this was coming out. Yeah, this was just coming out, and then the last day it was all over the news. I'm like, ah, hell. But I'm like, ah, whatever. I'll give you guys an easy one because it's going to come on next day. Yeah, so again, this is true as far as it goes. I don't know that I actually buy the argument, but this is what they say. So these were bones that were discovered. Look at the bones.
Always on
an island in, you know, in the Pacific, around the area where Amelia Earhart vanished in 1937, right? And they were discovered in 1940, so just a few years later. And analysis at the time indicated that they were the bones of a man. And so that seemed to lay to rest any question about whether or not they were Amelia Earhart's. But now the new analysis says, now, hold on, wait a minute. This is by Richard Jantz, and he says, the techniques they used at the time to determine that these were the bones of a man were not adequate to come to that conclusion, and that by more modern techniques wouldn't necessarily support that conclusion. Now, here's the thing. The bones were lost. We don't even have the bones.
Oh, jeez.
Oh,
no. Wait,
do we have the ghost memory of the bones?
We have data about the bones, like their measurements. That's it.
Look at the data.
He's basing
is it validated?
This.
Like, is the data good data?
I mean, it's based upon forensic scientists at the time analyzing the bones.
Okay.
So we have their data, but not the bones themselves.
But what happened to them?
They were lost. I don't know the details. But here's the thing. So Jantz's new analysis, he's not really saying that he can prove that it was a woman, just that the conclusion that it was a guy is not reliable. So we can't dismiss that it's Amelia Earhart based upon that 1940 analysis. But he also looked at the measurements of the bones, like how long was the humerus, how long was the ulnar, and then he found photos of Amelia Earhart where there was something in the picture that could be used for scale so that they can measure from the photo the length that Amelia Earhart's bones probably would be. And then what they did was they said, okay, well, how closely do the bones match Amelia Earhart's measurements compared to just reference, standard references? If we said, like, you know, if we looked at just hundreds of other individuals, you know, do these bones fit with Amelia Earhart more than an average person, an average reference skeleton?
Biometrics, yeah.
Yeah, and they said, and he concluded that the bones were a better match for Amelia Earhart than 99% of the individuals in a large reference sample. So that's why he concluded that they're probably her, you know, because of that analysis.
Hmm.
So that's the two parts of it. Probably not. We can't conclude that these were the bones of a guy based upon the old analysis, and this new analysis of the measurements do match well with Amelia Earhart. Still, I don't know. I just think it's a kind of a thin line of evidence since they don't really actually have the bones. And, you know, I don't know. I definitely want to see some more peer review on this.
Yeah.
Then they were also saying that, you know, along with those bones, they did find the case for a sextant that Amelia Earhart would have had and, you know, items that like an islander would not have had. And so, yeah, there's some circumstantial evidence. No plane, though. That's the thing. No plane. So what exactly happened? So no co-pilot, no navigator, right? So where's the navigator? I guess he could have drowned. Or they just
wait.
Never
did
found
she
him.
Wash up? Is that
well? That's what they that. Think? That must be the implication. Yeah. That she ditched, but she was within swimming distance of this island.
Oh, so were the bones found like on the shore or like in the
like
middle
in a
of
cave?
The
like in a
cave. Yeah. So that she would have probably walked there herself.
Yeah. Yeah. Without the plane, you know, I don't know. I'm not buying it. But it's. I guess it's possible. Just seems like a kind of a tenuous sort of a narrative that they're constructing there. But that is true. It was published in a forensic journal in Forensic Anthropology, and the analysis seems to be cromulent.
Oh, did you see that Embiggens was added to the dictionary?
Yeah, Embiggens.
I love that.
Embiggens is now a perfectly cromulent word.
Yeah.
Okay, so play must
which
be happy.
Means that a new study finds that couples have a highly accurate sense of what their partner is, of when their partner is sad or depressed. Is the fiction, your guys' anecdotal experience in this case, was correct? Because the study found that partners have a terrible sense of when their partner is sad or feeling down or depressed. But so what they found was that people actually have a good sense of when their partner's happy, but not so good a sense of when they're sad.
Yeah.
And that people rely upon other heuristics for that. Mm-hmm. They assume that their partner feels the same way that they do. So when they're happy, they assume their partner's happy. And they're not necessarily attentive to subtle cues that they're the soft negative, you know, emotion. So not like in a major depression, but just like sad or feeling down or mildly depressed. They kind of miss that. At the same time, people are not good at communicating that to their partner either. So it's kind of a two-way street, they're saying. So, you know, how people play the you should read my mind thing, like you should know. You should just know that I'm not happy. I shouldn't have to express myself to you. And the partner's like, everything's fine, right? So I'm fine. So they must be fine, you know?
That's always the most irritating conversation. You okay? Yeah, so I'm fine. Are you really fine? I'm fine. I said I'm fine. I'm not going to be fine anymore if you stop asking me if I'm fine.
Yeah, right, okay. Right, right. So they're saying, yeah, so it might be a good idea to both be more expressive you know, don't assume that your partner has radar and is going to know your mood magically somehow. It's okay to say, oh, I'm feeling a little depressed recently or whatever, or anxious. And don't just assume that if you're feeling okay, your partner's feeling okay. You could check in with them. How you doing? How was your day? How are you feeling recently? Things okay? You know? So basically the old, again, the sometimes old wisdom is holds up over time, and just the basic advice to couples of just communicate is like really holds up.
Mm-hmm.
Be communicative and communicate with your partner. That's still the key to, or one key to a healthy relationship.
That's crazy. And yeah,
people run into trouble because they're not asking. It's like, don't ask, don't tell, right? Not a good philosophy for a relationship.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I agree. What'd you think about the stuff I said? Like, you kind of, I was deliberately just not bringing it into the day-to-day interaction because I didn't want to have it affect the relationship.
Well, but it does. That's what I have to say about that is that just because you're not verbalizing it doesn't mean that it's not coming out in other behavioral ways.
Right. Jay, you know what makes me happy?
I do, Steve, and I know what you're about to say.
That the show's over?
We have 624 patrons.
Oh, no way. That's way nice. Happier.
Yeah.
Yeah, just 1 week. 1 week, we've got 624 patrons. So we're chugging along. Of course, we have a lot of goals at, you know, more higher and higher levels, but it's going well. If you haven't checked it out, take a look at our Patreon page. Just patreon.com/skepticsguide. Take a look at the levels and the goals that we have. We're really trying to build a community there. We've been having a lot of fun on the Discord server. That's really working well.
Yeah, you know, I was surprised at how much people had early adoption on that. Like, we got a ton of people on the Discord server now having conversations like constantly.
Ooh, I'm gonna
like,
open it
right now.
a little
beep that happens every time someone puts a post in the general folder, mm-hmm. or the general chat room. And I've been jumping in on and off all day because I'm behind a computer all day. You know, I got people, we're talking to people about the book tour and, you know, you got to come to our city and all that. And it seems like I'm seeing them launch off into dozens of conversations every hour. They're just, you know, random people on there talking about different stuff. And that's a lot of fun. It's been really cool. The interaction is way more engaging and fun than I planned on it being. Like, I got to keep myself from being on there as much as I am.
So Evan wasn't able to join us tonight because, you know, we had to reschedule because of the power outage. So I'm going to cover the quote of the week. This one comes from Christopher Hitchens, Letters to a Young Contrarian. He writes, "The essence of the independent mind lies not in what it thinks, but in how it thinks." I like that. That's a nice little sentiment. We echo that a lot. We're trying to discuss how to think, not necessarily tell people what to think. So I like that quote. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Sure, man. Steve.
And until next week, hopefully without any floods or power outages, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. And just a quick message to remind you that a business is only as strong as its people, and every hire matters. So don't settle for posting and hoping the right person will find your role and apply. Instead, choose LinkedIn. Go to linkedin.com/skeptics and get a $50 credit towards your first job post. That's linkedin.com/skeptics for your $50 credit today. Terms and conditions apply.